From WHQR Public Media, I'm Shauna Kenny, and this is Wild Things. I cover creatures and critters of the coastal Carolinas and the people who care for them. Come with me. Let's get wild. It's a sunny November day in this Carolina Beach backyard. Behind the boats and paddleboards, dozens of honeybees fly around the openings of 9 wooden brood boxes. The 2-lot property belongs to Sandy Seselski, a certified North Carolina beekeeper, honey producer, and volunteer coordinator for the New Hanover County Bee School. She tends to these honeybees year-round, especially in the winter, as the temperatures drop, the colony gets smaller, and resources diminish.
This time of year, there's not a lot of pollen and or nectar available for them. So they are relying very heavily on their honey stores. The bottom box is their brood where the queen and all of the baby bees and the nurse bees and the brood, that's where all of them live. And then the top box is full of honey. And that is their food that will help carry them over until the nectar flow begins again in February and early March.
Sandy will treat the bees for mites 3 times a year, as well as feed them some sugar syrup as a supplement to help them get through winter.
Unfortunately, in North America, we have to deal with the varroa mites. It is a scourge for honeybees, but an untreated colony will die.
Sticking together during their diapausal state also helps the bees' survival.
They're an insect, so they are ectothermic. They're not going to be able to have a way to keep their bodies warm like we as humans and coyotes and bears and other wildlife can stay warm in the winter. So they're very dependent on the warmth of the day. So in the winter, they're going to take advantage here of the eastern North Carolina warm days. This type of behavior you're seeing here of them flying around, going on some cleansing flights, and then maybe picking up some pollen or two, that's going to be the extent of it this time of year.
This is the time of year when the queen is laying less eggs and flying will diminish due to less sunshine. They'll ball up together to stay warm and wait for spring.
Me as a beekeeper, I'm not going to break that ball. I don't want to do anything. She could be moving up into that top box as they begin to consume all the honey that's in their reserves for the winter. She's going to start laying up in that smaller box that you see. And so therefore, if I as a beekeeper open it up, I'm going to break that brood. And that is not good.
Much of our human food supply relies upon pollinators like these bees. While eating and searching for nectar and flowers, pollen sticks to their fuzzy legs and gets deposited into the reproductive parts of fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds, allowing the plants to reproduce. The USDA estimates that 1 out of every 3 bites of food exists thanks to animal pollinators. Moths, wasps, and hummingbirds are but a few who could use our help in ensuring their survival. Perhaps start with not mowing your lawn, Sandy says, or at least selectively mowing.
By practicing no-mow March to no-mow May, you are providing the perfect environment for all of these pollinators to not only provide that service for all the plants, but for the things that feed on the pollinators. And it doesn't take much effort to just stop mowing to a little bit at a time, replace any grass that you have with more pollinator-friendly plants and also trees, which Wilmington can always use more trees. So many of the trees that we have, red maple and the American holly and the gallberry and the magnolia, all of these are flower producing plants that support dozens of varieties of pollinators.
If you cannot be a beekeeper yourself, you can support regional ecology by buying local instead of commercially produced honey. Beekeepers foster healthy bee populations and use sustainable practices in caring for their bees.
It's best to always buy local honey, and it's best to also purchase honey as close to where you live. Here in eastern North Carolina, with all the pine trees, as well as red maple and American holly and the magnolia. It's ubiquitous throughout our region. So to buy honey that is from your region is the best honey that you can buy. Also to purchase it from a local beekeeper that has to maintain professional standards for their honey. And you develop a personal relationship with the beekeeper and know that you're getting a quality product that has not been tainted or adulterated in any way. When you purchase honey in grocery stores, you just don't know. There's a reason why honey will never crystallize on a grocery store shelf. Often it's been cut with corn syrup because that prevents the natural crystallization.
The state of North Carolina is a leader in looking out for bees. North Carolina State University has an apiculture lab, also known as the Bee Lab, dedicated to research and instruction. The North Carolina Honeybee Act of 1977 also supports the work of backyard beekeepers like Sandy through regulations on disease control, pollination services, and the sales of bees. In 2012, Asheville established the Bee City USA Honor as a way to promote commitments to preserve native pollinators when experts started to notice the disappearance of bee colonies in 2006. Wilmington received its Bee City certification in June 2015. Today, there are 465 Bee Cities and campus affiliates. Then there are folks like Gabriella Garrison. She is the Eastern Piedmont Habitat Conservation Coordinator for the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. With the NCWRC, she oversees a 23-county area in the Piedmont, working with other government agencies, developers, and consultants to mitigate potential impacts of development. We met up at Carvers Creek State Park in the Sand Hills region of North Carolina to discuss other ways we can support our pollinators. Before we walk the trails of the longleaf pine forest, Gabriella shows me models she uses when educating the public about wildlife. One shows how ground-nesting native bees burrow in the soil in spring, summer, and fall after collecting pollen and nectar, then creating little yellow pollen balls.
She lays an egg on them, so that's what that is right there, an egg. And then when she's done creating this incredible architectural feat, she seals off the top of the tunnel, and then the eggs hatch, and then they develop into larvae, which eat the pollen resources, and they go through a couple more stages of development in which they form a pupa, which is kind of a more identifiable form of a bee, and then they emerge the following year. So most bees, they spend the majority of their life in this stage underground developing. And so they're really only above the surface for a very short amount of time during the year, a month or two, depending on the species and the time of year. But it's kind of cool. I always tell people, imagine when you're walking through the woods across the forest floor, you're walking over this.
She shows me a recreated bumblebee colony nested within a Tupperware filled with straw. A queen will lay eggs atop what are called wax pots. She also shows me a model of a stem cross-section where cavity nesting insects lay eggs and seal themselves off for development through the winter as well.
We always encourage people to leave standing stems in the fall to not rake away their leaf litter because a lot of things hang out under the leaf litter in the pine straw. And so what's curious though about the stems is that we've actually kind of had a little bit of a turn of thought because it used to be that we didn't tell people to cut back stems until the spring. But now, thanks to some research done at NC State, the recommendation is to cut back stems in the fall.
As we walk the pine needle-covered sandy trails, she stops to demonstrate by breaking off the top of a dried-up black-eyed Susan.
This is a pretty nice stem. I bet it's going to have a hollow center. If I cut this stem back now, I'm still leaving it standing, so it's, what, about 2 feet above ground or so. But in February, when the bees start to emerge, there's a chance that maybe a bee will find this open area that it thinks this could be where I'm going to nest. This is where I'm going to put my babies. Versus if I had just left this stem standing, eventually it would have gotten knocked over time. But if I went back and I kind of made the work a little bit easier for her, Because if you think about it, February is really just around the corner, the way that time flies. So now we suggest that people, if you have a stem, wait for the birds to get all the dried seeds off of it, because that's a really, really important form of forage for birds in the fall. But once all the seeds are gone from the dead flower head, start cutting back the stems a couple feet off the ground so that come February and March, when these bees start emerging in the spring, they have ready-made nesting habitat. But never cut it back to the ground, because a lot of people like to cut it flush to the ground. I mean, they might go all the way down a foot into the tube to lay their eggs, because they create those little chambers like I had shown you before. They'll put their pollen ball in, they'll lay an egg, and then she will seal it off. Each little pollen ball and egg gets their own room, so to speak. And then she'll kind of work her way back up to the top of the stem. And then when she's done, she'll seal off that hole so it's relatively protected, and then she'll go off and she might find another stem, or that might be the end of her life cycle.
Many experts recommend leaving a few wildflowers in your yard just for this reason. Gabriella says she doesn't mow her own yard at all. Some good plants to keep are those with hollow or pithy stems. These include bee balm, goldenrod, Joe Pye weed, ironweed, mountain mint, and asters, among others.
I really don't cut things down to the ground at all, but I understand that to a lot of people that looks messy. But now there are a lot of signs that you can get to put up in your yard so people know what you're doing is intentional. So to me, the aesthetic of my yard at my home, I have a lot of wildflowers. There's not a lot of prim and proper look to it, but it looks like a wild garden to me. And that's my happy aesthetic. And so that's what we're trying to do, change how people view things.
Brush, limbs, dead plants, and logs are all wildlife habitats too.
So this is a log that's on the ground. It's clearly fallen from a tree. And so beetles will come in a lot of time, especially as the wood gets softer, and they'll bore little holes in it. Trying to see if I can find an example of that. They can kind of see where there's the beginnings of maybe some insects boring little holes in it, like right there and right there. And so over time, once the beetles are done with it, little solitary bees or solitary wasps, they'll go in behind them and they'll use that kind of the equivalent as a stem.
Unlike the well-kept honeybees of beekeepers like Sandy, the native bees are on their own come spring. Gabriella helps them by offering them more natural resources.
I make such a point in my yard of trying to have forage available really early in the season, just because when the bees are emerging in February, they're really hungry. They've been developing underground or in a cavity or in some nook wherever they've been.
And even though honeybees can travel a couple of miles to look for food, doing so uses energy and calories that could be better used for breeding. Others, like wasps and butterflies, can't fly quite as far. She tells me that native female bees intentionally collect pollen to feed their young while drinking nectar for energy for themselves along the way. The nectar and pollen bind together to make a pollen ball, as pollen collects on their furry bodies too. Butterflies do this as well, but moths may be even more efficient.
There are some butterflies that are a little bit furry looking, but they're not hairy like a bee is. However, if you look at a moth up close, a lot of moths are really furry looking. And so I think a lot of folks are starting to realize that they do collect pollen more efficiently than previously thought, thereby distributing it from flower to flower more efficiently. But the thing about moths is that they're not intentionally trying to collect pollen. They just kind of collect it by happenstance because they're furry and they're on the flower.
Then there are the hummingbirds, who generally fly further south in the winter.
We have the one species here reliably, which is the ruby-throated hummingbird. And then every now and then, we'll kind of get a straggler that's veered off course from a more western part of the country. But for the most part, we have our ruby-throated hummingbird. And they're pretty cool because they tend to visit these really long tubular flowers. And that makes sense because they have that really long bill and they stick the bill in there and they tend to get really deep into the flower, at which point that's when they kind of collect pollen and they'll transfer it from flower to flower. But again, not as efficient as a bee. They don't have the appendages to collect the pollen.
Some stick around the coastal Carolinas through winter because of our mild climate And many people leave out hummingbird feeders year round.
If you're going to have a hummingbird feeder on the coast in the winter, then just please make sure it stays clean. They do tend to eat other things. A lot of times people will see hummingbirds hanging out around spider webs. They'll pick little pieces of insects and such out of the spider web. And sometimes they'll eat too. You know, if you see the bits of sap running down some trees, some pine trees, they'll pick some of the pieces of sap as well.
When it comes to pesticides, the new Hanover County Health Department has a policy that supports backyard beekeepers. Through the Vector Control Division, backyard beekeepers can register their apiaries so that mosquito spraying does not occur near active honeybee colonies. Beekeepers are asked to reach out to their neighbors to sign off on a no-spray zone. The automated mosquito spraying phone/email notification system then alerts the beekeeper when spraying is occurring in their area, and the spray system is deactivated within 200 yards of the active apiary. The Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation recommends prevention and monitoring mosquitoes rather than using pesticides in order to keep pollinators safe. Regarding spraying around wild bees, Gabriella suggests communication.
If your neighbor sprays, there's no imaginary boundary from your yard that's going to keep that drift from coming into your yard. So it's really important to have those conversations with your neighbors, because what my neighbor does certainly impacts what happens in my yard.
So add speaking with our neighbors to the list of simple ways we can support pollinators. We can work together to get things done, just like the bees. I'm your host, Shauna Kenny, and this has been Wild Things. Many thanks to Mike Holliday for the music, Kel Skonberg for mixing and editing, Jeffrey Everett for the logo, and Ben Shockman for production. This is all made possible by a grant from the Fourth Estate Fund. Thanks for listening. See you in the wild.